So the theme for this retreat is equanimity. And I think of equanimity as one of the great gifts of mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice has a lot of gifts, and the reason I call it one of the great gifts is that it really makes life so much easier to navigate if we have some strong sense of inner balance, kind of stable sense in the mind, so that the mind isn't kind of reacting to every little thing that comes its way. And it's quite a beautiful state, the state of equanimity, or the states of equanimity. It's not clear there's only one kind of it. There's not one kind of equanimity. There's a whole bunch of them, and Nikki last night listed many of them. And these different lists that have equanimity in it, equanimity has a different function. So it has many different functions in our lives, so it's multifunctional. And I think it's also experienced differently, the different kinds of equanimity. And but sometimes, especially in meditation, it can be actually a very strong state. And I was quite surprised when I first encountered this on some of my early retreats. I think that before I came to Buddhism, I probably knew what the word equanimity was if someone spoke it. I doubt it was in my spoken vocabulary. It was, you know, and equanimous probably I didn't know was a word until I came to Buddhism. Maybe some of you also, equanimous? And but when one of my first long Vipassana retreats, I was so surprised to discover that I experienced it as a very precise, defined, clear state. It was like, you know, as clear as the sun has come out after the clouds have parted. It was like, wow, there it is. And it was such an all-encompassing state. You know, I would say it was an embodied state, but that it also clearly involved the mind, a kind of clarity, tranquility, openness, stability of mind, of heart, of body. And it felt very, very nourishing. It was not aloof. It was not indifferent. It wasn't some kind of restraint from reactivity or anything. But it was kind of this deep peacefulness. There was kind of a deep knowing that this mind was so stable, this heart was so still or stable, that whatever came its way, it wasn't going to react. It wasn't going to be for or against or go towards or go away and have ideas of for and against. It would just kind of be there in a strong, you know, just be the present. The tradition likens such strong equanimity to the full moon. Sometimes the moon is obscured, sometimes it's a quarter moon or new moon, but to have it, you know, so kind of fully radiant in a clear, open sky. The most recent time that I was inspired by the full moon was this July up here in these mountains, in Santa Cruz Mountains, 2 o'clock at night on a ridge, and the moon was so bright, you know, like I could see for miles from the ridge down the hill, you know, the steps of mountain ranges going down towards the coast or down towards IRC or something. And, you know, wow, it was a beautiful, I think I probably could have read, the moon was so bright up there. And so equanimity with that kind of clarity. So it's one of the great gifts that comes from practice. And some aspects of it might come quickly, and some of the more, you know, I don't know what adjective to use, but some of the other warm forms might come from lots of practice, the continuity of practice that builds over time. And I want to tell you an equanimity story, partly because it involves three words that are three wonderful words you can memorize and maybe use for yourself. You'll find the equanimity phrases that you might be useful as you go about. So it has to do with a Zen teacher in Japan about 200 years ago named Hakuin, somewhat famous monk. And he lived in a village with a little temple. And there was a teenage woman of living at home with her parents who got pregnant by one of the neighboring teenage boys. And so when it was clear that she was pregnant, the parents demanded that she tell them who the father was. And she didn't want to reveal who her friend was because that maybe was dangerous for or problematic in who knows what kind of ways. So she said, "It's the priest, the Zen master down the street in the temple." So when the child was born, the parents brought it to Hakuin and said, "This is yours. Take care of it." And Hakuin said the three words. He said, "Is that so?" And then he took the baby and took good care of it, in spite of the fact that probably his reputation was challenged in the village, and probably his, all kinds of things. He received probably a lot of blame. Probably it was a lot of work to take care of a baby, and probably it was lots of discomfort of sleepless nights and all kinds of things that he had to then. But he just kind of, "Is that so?" And the story goes that he took care of the baby well. And then after a few months, the young woman decided that this wasn't tenable anymore. And so she went and told her parents who the real father was. And so the parents went back to the temple and explained what had happened and said, "We'd like the baby back." And Hakuin said, "Is that so?" And handed the baby back. And so, is that so? So, I find that very useful sometimes, that statement, "Is that so?" It's kind of for me, it's an expression of, "Is that so? And let's take another look. Is that so? Let's see if it's so." As opposed to immediately reacting, immediately getting swept up in our opinions, our judgments, our desires, our aversions, our agitation around something, but to kind of lean back, step back, settle in, and say, "Oh, is that so?" That creates space and room for see what's going on, check it out. That is a little movement of equanimity. Is that so? And it's not approving of something. It's not disapproving of something. It's just like, check it out. Okay, is that so? And then the idea for me is that if you then bring your mindfulness to the experience of whatever's happening, first and foremost, before the reactivity or before you react with the reactivity, that then there's a chance to kind of take in the situation much better. And chance for some wisdom and clear seeing and basic street smarts to come into play so that, we can do the wise thing or the appropriate thing in a situation, or more likely can. And so as you go through this retreat, it's one of the little, tools you can have in your tool bag. It might occasionally be appropriate for you to say to yourself, "Is that so?" You carrying your soup and across the dining room, and you somehow slips out of your hands, crash, shatters, and the soup spreads across the floor. Is that so? And if you want to really kind of bring up the big ammunition for equanimity, wow. That's just one word. Wow. And this is the place to do that. Unless someone's going to slip on the soup on the floor or something. We're all going to go, is that so? Wow. This is the place to be equanimous. This is the place where it's okay. And then, you know, you'll clean it up, someone will come and help you, and something will happen. But imagine that, to, you know, having this right in the middle of the community in the dining room floor, it shatters. Everyone turns and looks. Oh, is that so? So what's, what really kind of works? What would really work if you had those three words? What does it really touch? What difference does it make? And that comes from, I think that's an interesting question, because to really have effective equanimity, it helps to study, be aware of how we're not equanimous, and be interested in that, and not see it as a mistake to be non-equanimous, to be agitated, to be reactive, to be caught up in our stuff and kind of spinning in the mind or spinning in the heart, whatever it might be. But to stop and take a look, what's going on now? And as many of you know, I love the word respect as a kind of synonym for mindfulness, because the Latin meaning of respect means to look again. And so to take a look, second look, third look, fourth look, at what our reactivity is, what's going on here. That very action of turning towards and looking at something is a beginning of equanimity. It's a beginning of stepping away from the reactivity and bringing some kind of balanced looking, some kind of simple, non-reactive looking to, oh, this is what's going on. And so it might be that on that dining room floor, the soup and the plates shattered all over, and maybe you're not going to be equanimous. Maybe this is your worst fear of what happened at IRC. And so suddenly there's a huge alarm and fear about, you know, they'll probably ask me to leave or something from this. And so to look towards that, well, I'm not equanimous, that's clear. Let me look at this. Gail said I didn't have to pick it up and clean it up immediately. So let me stand here for 5 seconds and look at it. That movement of looking at it is beginning of not being so caught by it, making space for it, taking the bigger picture in, seeing what's going on here, what's happening. So you don't have to be equanimous to do the practice, you know. But to do the practice can also include looking at and studying and understanding how this works. Maybe Nikki said this. I apologize if I'm repeating it. That the word equanimity, in Pali, upekkha, comes from the expression to look towards something, to have an overview of it. And I like the idea that bird's eye view, but it has to do with seeing. So they respect, investigating, looking at it more carefully. And the tradition offers us all kinds of ways, the areas in which we lose our equanimity. And one interesting is a list called the 8 Worldly Winds. And so these are ways which, often in life, it's very easy we get tripped up around these things. And the first one is praise or blame. And some people are fueled by praise, like, you know, almost their sense of self, their energy and life gets, you know, they crave it, they want it, they get pumped up by it. And my impression is the more someone really depends on and gets pumped up, the more they get kind of pumped up by blame as a negative, because it's so important, it's so meaningful, so threatening. And so they get activated by that. But it's easy to get, I think for human beings, it's so easy to be concerned with the praise of others, the blame of others. Some people it's tied to issues of safety. Some people it's tied to issues of worth. All kinds of issues can come along with that. But regardless of what kind of the source of it in us, to recognize how it agitates us, how it kind of stirs us up, is, and then perhaps over time learn that maybe we don't have to be as stirred up as we were, as we think we do. I suspect that some of the ways that you were praised and blamed and earlier in your life, maybe as a teenager, would kind of, you're pretty equanimous now. It's like, you know, if someone, criticized me for being a really bad basketball player. I mean, in junior high school, that was bad news. I probably wouldn't have slept. But, you know, you can tell me that now, and boy, I'm so even and calm. That would be a good, you know. And so praise and blame. And to question it, to question how much we get tripped by it, how important it is for us, how reactive we are. What is it really about that we get so caught up in praise and blame? So if someone praises you, you can say, might not want to say it out loud, but in your mind you say, is that so? Someone blames you, is that so? I love this little poem by the Buddha that goes, they'll blame you if you talk too much. They'll blame you if you talk too little. They'll blame you if you talk just right. No one in this world is free of blame. So is it true what he's saying? But I kind of like it that, you know, that we go through this world and someone's going to criticize us or blame us. That just comes with the territory of being a human being for something or other, sooner or later. And if we just see it as part of the human condition, maybe it should be addressed, and maybe, depending on what people say, it should be addressed and rectified or something. But the issue is not whether it's right or wrong, the blame. The issue is, do we get stirred up by it? Do we get agitated? If it needs to be rectified, probably that rectification can be done much better if we're equanimous. Equanimity allows for the clear thinking. It allows for clear seeing of the situation. So praise and blame. The second is success and failure. And some people are very tuned in to their success and failure and things. And somehow, maybe because of the family or the communities they grew up in or something, the idea of success and failure has huge meaning for them. And it's very difficult to fail. Somehow, growing up, their family was very critical, didn't have no space for failure. People were pushed so much by their parents. And so they always had to succeed higher and higher and higher. And so the idea of success and failure carries a lot of baggage for some people. And given that, it's easy to imagine that how easy it is to get stirred up or agitated or upset or dismayed or discouraged by success and failure. And people will come on retreat carrying with them attitudes about success and failure they apply to the retreat. And if they have some idea, expectation of what it's supposed to look like to be successful, and that doesn't happen on the retreat, it's not just simply, well, that was too bad, or is that so? It's like, shoot, you know, this is, you know, I just blew it, I was not good enough, I was this and that, or that retreat center is a really bad place. It's like, can't believe it, you know, no one will get concentrated in that place. You know, that's all the fault of the place or the teachers. You know, that's the problem. And so success and failure. So to have equanimity about success and failure. And one of the ways to do that, which I think is people have talked about it, written about it quite a bit, is to understand the value of failure, that failure is an occasion to learn a lot, to strengthen oneself, to refine one's skills, to take another look, and to kind of learn kind of mastery. If everything we did, everything anybody ever did was a success the first time, it probably wouldn't be that great. some things become great because they get refined and refined and worked with and until kind of the greatness comes out. I remember when I was in graduate school, you probably won't believe me, but I really didn't know how to write when I started graduate school. My wife looked at me, and my first paper I wrote, I said, "Can you edit this?" And she looked at the paper, and she looked at me, and, "Where did you go to school? You don't know how to spell. You don't know grammar." It was quite something. And I'd spent two whole days writing two pages. You know, that's it was so hard for me. So I had a professor who wrote, my kind of main advisor, who wrote these wonderful academic papers that read like mystery novels. Like you were just pulled into them. They were seamless. They were brilliantly written. And it's like, that was this. So then I had this two examples. My struggles with spelling and grammar and her, you know, just brilliantly, smoothly written papers. And then one day she shared with me a draft of one of the papers she was writing. And to my shock, it was full of cross-outs. It was full of writing in the margins. It was full of taking blocks of text and arrows pointing where somewhere else should go. And I said, you know, whole paragraphs were crossed out. And I said, wow, she's failing too. There's a lot of failure here. I guess that's part of the deal. Is, you know, you're not successful the first time. And so, and part of the strength we develop in practice comes from the fact that we're not successful. Most of us do not have a good batting average when it comes for being concentrated in the present moment. But that's how we develop the strength, by practicing and practicing and practicing that learning, understanding ourselves. And sometimes I think that hugely more important than some of the things we can call success in meditation is what we learn from the failure. So a classic example would be, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on the value of concentration, or today, or this retreat on equanimity. And so you might think, well, okay, for this retreat to be successful, I got to be, you know, like a full moon by Saturday, you know, really, you know, chilled out and, you know, and that might not happen. But in the process of thinking about equanimity, looking at it, noticing how you're not, you might learn a lot about yourself, but how you're not equanimous. And that might be really useful. That knowledge is portable. You'll take it with you the rest of your life, maybe, and notice when that happens, be wiser about when it happens, know how maybe how to let go of it when it happens, something. But if you're only focusing on the success of being equanimous or the success of being concentrated, and you leave here and go out on the Highway 17, the so-called success you had might disappear before you get to the next exit. And, you know, sometimes on Sunday, the traffic is beach traffic. No, not this time of year, but I try to go home sometimes on Sunday after the Sunday beach traffic. And it's either a great place for equanimity or hard. So what I'm trying to say is that if you have conventional success of being concentrated easily, real easily, you might not learn so much about yourself. And the learning where we're attached, learning how we get caught, is really a hugely big part of this practice. Because that's really the movement, the direction we're going, is to be free. Free of attachments, free of clinging. We're not moving in the direction of just living in a cloud of concentration for the rest of our life, or equanimity the rest of our life. So success and failure, is that so? Let's take a look at this. Let's not get caught up in success and failure. Let's see what's happening here. The third pair of worldly winds is pleasure and pain. And some people are particularly concerned with this idea of pleasure and pain for many reasons why, but just the basic kind of sensory pleasures, sensory pains that we can experience as we go along here. If For some people, that's a sign of success and failure. The more pleasure we have, the more we feel like we're on a good track, or we're successful, or we're right, or something. And if we feel pain, something's wrong. I did something wrong. There's something wrong with the world. I think one of the great gifts that I've had from the practice is to have the capacity to experience pleasure and pain and have some equanimity about it, not be caught by it, not be reactive to it, to be spacious, to be allowing, to be wise, to be able to even be joyful with pain. I would have thought, you know, when I started practice, that those two feelings are not compatible. But it's actually possible to have joy at the same time as having intense physical pain. Not easy to have that, but that's something that I've experienced that came from doing the practice. So pleasure and pain comes into, you know, how are we swept around by them? How do we get reactive to them? How do we, you know, get caught? And we will get caught in all these things. Part of equanimity is to say, do the equivalent of, is that so? And take a good look. Respect yourself. Respect what's happening. Take a second look. What is this? What is this? What is this? And it's almost as if, what is this? Or is that so? Is beginning to find a new relationship to whatever is happening. And it isn't so much that we have to penetrate what's happening with some great insightful insight, but rather we're learning how to have a wise, careful, balanced relationship to what's happening. So part of this equanimity, and is this so, and let's take a better look, is really keeps coming back intimately to ourselves. How am I with this experience? How am I now? How am I? The last of the worldly winds are fame and disrepute. So praise and blame is kind of more maybe for specific things. Fame is how more generally, I guess, you're seen by a wide group of people. And you're famous. 15 minutes of fame. Instagram fame. Oh, you know, Facebook fame. There's great, all kinds of forms of fame, where you're so famous by all these, so many people who don't know you. And apparently there's, you know, serious psychological difficulties in our world now because of people who are so caught up in how many likes they have by people who don't know them. You know, it's kind of a... So to understand that, to look at that, how is that it works for me? And is it possible to be famous? Is it possible to have a bad reputation? And be equanimous about that, to have some balance around that. So what I'm trying to emphasize here is that as important as equanimity is, that the lack of equanimity is also important for this practice. It's best to take the lack of equanimity best to not take it as a mistake. Not take it as something unfortunate, unnecessary, but take it as, given that this is happening, if this is what's happening, then let me take a good look at it. Let me not only look at it and understand it better, but let me take a good look at myself in relationship to it. And is there some way that I can be more calm, relaxed, non-reactive about this? Can I breathe with it? Can I take a good look at it? So is that so? So then there's cultivating equanimity around particular parts of our lives. That maybe you can understand why mindfulness is so useful for this way. So there's equanimity about what we're thinking about. Our thoughts. And I think for people who don't practice mindfulness, it's very easy to be closely identified with our thoughts. we are our thoughts, or thoughts are kind of at the center of who we are, or represent who we are, or if I think it, then I am that, or something. If I think it, it's true. And it's, you know, the identification with our thoughts, the thinking can be so tight. It's also possible to step back from thinking and just see it as thoughts. And a very powerful little expression is, it's just a thought. Not to be dismissive of it, not to be to consider it as being inaccurate or, you know, or unimportant, perhaps, but it's just a thought, so that we're not overly invested in it. We're overly weighed down by it. We're overly reactive to it and spinning out on it. Look at that. Is that so? This very successful label that I've used for my successful for me around thinking is when all else fails is to use the expression, wow. Wow, look at what my mind can do. And somehow by saying wow, I kind of little, I'm better able to kind of pull myself away from being mired in the thinking and all that. I begin this process of kind of being free from it, and or getting the overview. Equanimity is the overview of it. Oh, there, it's a thinking. It's just a thought. Look at that. And I've learned over, I'm a slow learner sometimes, so it took a long time, that the thoughts I had about the future, the predictions, tended not to turn out that way. My batting average for successfully predicting my future, what's going to happen in this meeting, this event, this, that, whatever's coming up, was actually abysmal. And it helped me to see these thoughts of the future coming up. It had a lot to do with fear when I was younger, fear of what's going to happen there. See the thoughts come up and see them, look at that, it's just a thought. And now sometimes the thoughts like that still come up. And not only do I sometimes just see, oh, just a thought, look, that's interesting, that I should have that thought, and it just kind of comes through. But when the equanimity is strong, and this is one of the great delights of equanimity, is that there's something about the equanimous mind that, I don't know if this is true for anyone else, but it's true for me, that when I see thoughts arise, especially thoughts which are a little bit odd, I don't know if you have odd thoughts, but a little bit, they come up, and I really see them in the field of equanimity, I'm just delighted. Sometimes I'll smile. And I've looked at, you know, the smiling, and sometimes I get amused. Wow, I'm tickled. And I've kind of tried to rationalize why I should be doing this. Like, what's the reason? And I feel like I have to have a good reason for, you know, being so amused by these strange thoughts that come up sometimes. And I've kind of given up trying to justify it. I just think, just amused, tickled. But I think part of that is I don't take them so seriously. I just see them as thoughts coming up. And they're not mine, but they're not anybody else's. I mean, they're more mine than anybody else, but they're just there. And I go, wow, okay. And whereas when I was younger, every thought was so monumental, so consequential, was a reason to get pulled into its net, you know, glued to it. And now this is kind of in the space of freedom. And maybe it's the delight in the freedom that I can feel. It's almost like it highlights the freedom to have an odd thought and not buy into it. Wow, this is cool. I'm free. So equanimity can be quite amusing, a source of amusement or a reason for amusement. So to be able to have some equanimity about our thoughts, some spaciousness, some overview. There's also equanimity about our emotions. And I think that every emotion should be respected. That emotions are all have a purpose. They're there for a reason. They're there. They're expressing something. There's something for us to learn in them. Sometimes what we learn is how we've been caught by something, where we're attached, and that's valuable to see. Sometimes we learn other things about ourselves. Sometimes we learn beautiful things about ourselves. Even sometimes with difficult emotions or painful emotions, fear and anger sometimes, if you really pay attention to it, you might discover that buried in them is something quite valuable, a treasure, precious, that somehow got there was some misfiring around it or something. So to be able to stop and take a look at our emotions, to have the overview, to have this kind of looking towards what APEKKA stands for, as opposed to being swept into them or pulled away from them, reactive to and repulsed by them, agitated by them. But here, it's an emotion. Look at this. Is this so? I'm angry. Is this so? I'm hurt. Is this so? Or if you need the big ammunition, wow, I'm angry. Amazing, wow. I bet I could power California's electric grid. This is like, wow. Hopefully many of you have heard a lot of the instructions on mindfulness of emotions, but to really kind of apply the mindfulness is the beginning or is an aspect of starting to be equanimous, starting to be non-reactive, non-judgmental about it, just allowing it to be there, to allow the pristine simplicity of an emotion just to be present and be there. I think of meditation practice like we do here is one of the maybe very few places in the world where it's okay, it's allowed, it's even, I don't know if encourage is the right word, because that might fuel it, but it's really appropriate to let whatever emotion that's arising to show itself, to be there. In this context of meditation, you don't have to feel shame, you don't have to feel angry, you don't have to have delusions of grandeur. You don't have to do anything with it except get out of the way and really see it, know it. And part of the reason it's safe to do it here is that you're kind of committed in the course of the meditations, sitting still or walking, just walk back and forth. You're kind of not going to do any damage. Your eyes are closed. You look like, a Buddha to everyone else. And inside, you're all this stuff is going on. And it's valuable. It's valuable to learn how not to get caught up in the emotional life we have, no matter how strong. It's valuable to give it its freedom. We don't really know what's really operating, what's really being expressed and coming forth. And sometimes it's very respectful to give time for it, to let kind of the volcano bubble up and surface and be there without trying to tamp it down or plug it up and see what happens. And there's a wonderful story, a true story in Thailand of Buddha, someone who was sitting like a Buddha. It was a statue. It was a very big clay statue. And at some point, it lived in his temple for a long time. And at some point, apparently, maybe it was one of the times, periodically the Burmese invaded Thailand. And they were coming in, I guess. And so they said, we have to get this Buddha away from them. They might destroy it. And so they started to lift it up. I think this is the story. Anyway, somehow they were lifting it up. And in the process of lifting it up, some of the clay broke. And lo and behold, the statue was gold. And it was a big gold, pure gold statue. And so they chipped away all the clay. I think this is about the Burmese. I think what happened was that 200 or 300 years ago, they put clay around it to protect it from the Burmese. That's what happened. And so then in the modern era, they were going to move it or something, and they discovered it was gold. And now it lives in Bangkok. You can go visit it. I visited when I was 11. Formative influence. And so who knows what Buddha you have inside that is covered by mud of these difficult emotions that might arise, or beautiful emotions that might arise. So to be equanimous, to allow them to make space for things, to look at how am I in relationship to it? Am I frightened? Am I upset? Am I judging it? Am I judging myself? Am I discouraged? Is there a different how? And is of how to be. And one different way of how to be is just kind of metaphorically kind of tip your head to the side and, is that so? That's so. Is that how it is now? Another equanimity word that I think of it as, that I like love for the word equanimity, is the word, there's the expression, it's okay. It's okay. And sometimes I'll say that, and that kind of quiets things down, or it allows me just to be present for what's there. And that's kind of the litmus test. Can you just be present without needing to do anything with it? So it's okay. This can be there. Let's just be there and see it and be with it, feel it, sense it. So equanimity, and there are many things that support equanimity. And one of the great supports is our faith or confidence and trust in the practice, or trust in the Dharma, like I talked about last night, trust in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. People who trust the practice, then you know you have a resource. You know you have something that will support you and help you. That if you didn't know it, you had it, you might flounder. You might get all excited and run around. It's like maybe, you know, you don't know how to swim and you fall in the water. And so you trash your rep out more than you need to. But if you have a life jacket on, then, you know, you can kind of paddle around. So if you know you have the practice, you don't have to trash about so much. You don't be so worried or upset or have scenarios of how things are going to turn out bad. But just keep practicing and just trusting the practice. Oh, the practice works. Just stay. And it's a little bit, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you rely on the practice and trust it and just give yourself to it, then you're not giving yourself in to the despair or the upset or the reactivity that is going on. So part of the support for equanimity, being balanced, being even-minded, being continuous, just being chilled enough to stay and stay present, is just keep trusting the mindfulness and coming back to it and just relying on it over and over again. And that's one of the great gifts that I feel I received from the mindfulness practice, is I trust it, you know, with probably almost more than anything else. I probably trust mindfulness more than I trust the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. If you know, if you really got down to it, like, Gil, you get to take only one thing with you to the, you know, to a deserted island. You know, you can choose, take the Buddha, the Dharma, Sangha, or mindfulness. So I would choose mindfulness. And another thing that supports equanimity is ethics, is being ethical, ethical integrity, that somehow that creates a less cause for, less reasons to feel bad about oneself, feel discouraged by oneself, to be worried about what people think so much. And just, you know, you can be at ease with having confidence in your own integrity. It's a beautiful quality to have. Something else that gives equanimity is a certain kind of equanimity is cultivating strong personal qualities. So strengthening, developing mindfulness. Mindfulness is like a muscle that you can develop. The muscle of concentration, the muscle of letting go, the muscle of equanimity itself. the muscle of investigation. Like, I'm going to take a really good look at what's going on here. The muscle of just coming back to your breathing and just learning how to hang in there and massage yourself with the breath or settle on the breath. So all these things you can cultivate and develop. There's lots and lots of qualities. And that develops strength. And when you're stronger, there's more balance. So I liken it to if you've worked out, you know, quite a bit, exercised quite a bit, and there's a kind of energy of the exercise, strength that's developed, then, you know, it's a lot easier to be confident as we go through the world. I've had surgeries where afterwards I felt very, very fragile. And then as I got back into my exercise routine, I started feeling strong again. I could go through crowds of people and feel kind of confident that I had the ability, you know, not to get jostled around or lose my balance. So the same thing psychologically, we can develop these qualities inside. And one of the things we're doing here in this retreat is actually developing these strengths. And the developing strengths don't require you to be successful in terms of attaining some state while you're here. It might be the biggest benefit you get from this retreat is not, you know, that you've gotten some wonderfully bliss state, but rather you develop strength in patience. And gotten strength in just kind of not getting caught up in impatience. And you leave the retreat and you feel, well, that was a dud. Nothing happened. I had none of these wonderful, blissful attainments. And then you go back someplace to your life, and there's a hugely difficult issue has come up. Big, big, very confusing, frustrating, difficult to figure out, but you know, and you're so patient with it. And you realize, oh, that's what the retreat was about. I'm so glad I did that retreat. I was cultivating patience. I used to have a lot of knee pain when I sat. I should have my certificate in Buddhism on, bachelor's in knee pain. And I thought it was just a bad thing. But I learned so much about myself. I learned so much about my reactivity, my judgments, my self-identities that I had around how I was supposed to be as a meditator, as a whatever I was. And so we're building these strengths of understanding, strengths of letting go, strengths of patience, all these things. And that gives birth to a form of equanimity that's called Tatra Majja Tata. What do you think of that word? It's a big word. It's made up of three little words. Tatra means this. I think. Yeah, and Majja means in the middle, and Tata means standing in or being in. Standing in the middle of this. So just be able to stand on your both feet, stand in the middle of whatever's happening, in the balance point. And be able to stand there in an equanimous way. So to be balanced. The image I have for that is standing on a seesaw in the middle with one foot on either side of the fulcrum and just holding it completely still, you know, parallel to the ground. And, you know, you're balanced. You have the sense of balance with the situation and evenness of what goes on. And that balance doesn't come necessarily from the psychological work of trying not to give in to the reactivity. Trying not to get caught or something and restraining oneself from, you know, trying not to get, but it comes from rather from the inner strength that I think all of you have. All of you have some strength, probably more than you realize. And for you to kind of have some challenge while you're meditating, while you're doing walking meditation, while you're on retreat, and actually physically, and how you sit, how you stand, how you are, to sit in a way that expresses strength. If you have a posture that expresses the opposite of strength, that's what gets reinforced. If you take a posture that expresses your strength, that's what gets reinforced. And I suspect that all of you have much more strength than you're willing to give yourself credit for. And you might consider that maybe you can have more balance, more equanimity, more ability to be centered and not swayed by the winds of the world, not swayed by the compulsions of the thoughts, of the strength of the emotions, but maybe just tapping into your personal strength, sitting up straighter, sitting a little bit stronger, sitting with more stability, maybe brightening the mind a little bit, relaxing the mind a little bit. So a strength of attention, a stability of attention can support you to take a good look at what's happening. The alternative, I think, to calling on some of your strength might unfortunately be too easily losing your balance, slipping on the sidewalk, slipping away into a thought pattern, into a train of thought, into a train of judgments, into a train of despair, into a train of fantasies that might go on. Just keep slipping into it. But if you could somehow touch what is strong inside of you, feel it physically, feel it mentally, feel it emotionally, even if it's just a hint of it, you might find that you don't slip off so easily. You might be able to stand in the middle of all this with some balance and some equanimity. And if you're not equanimous, is that so? And then see if you can be equanimous about not being equanimous. And if you can't, just forget the whole equanimous thing. And just kind of go back to your breathing. Start over. So thank you so much. And I'll end with this that I feel often on the first day of the retreat, is I just feel so much gratitude for the people who come to retreat. And first days are often quite difficult for people, with pain and headaches, and mind is unruly, and all kinds of issues might come up. It's not a mistake that these things happen, but they can be quite difficult. And I felt that what I've felt so far today, I'm just delighted, enjoyed, appreciated, have tremendous respect for what you've been doing here, what you're doing today. And don't take it for granted. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing that you're offering yourself to over to. So please continue. Thank you.